Okay, I want to discuss two separate topics that probably have some connection one with the other. Okay. The first one is back from the Sedra of Nosso, and the second one is from last week's Sedra Balosha. I hope we'll get to cover both of them. Try to time it so we do cover both. The Sedra of Nosso, the focal point of the Sedra is Birkas Kohanim. It's the middle of the Sedra, and I once explained here why all of the episodes or all of the components of that Sedra really represent different ideas of Shalom. But I want to hone in on what exactly Shalom is. Shalom, first of all, doesn't mean peace, serenity. It means shlemus, perfection. When there's perfection, then there is peace and there's serenity or whatever, real perfection and harmony. But it means many things working together harmoniously for the most perfection that could be in this world. Because perfection in this world, except for the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, who's perfect, nothing is perfect in this world. So perfection can only be reached by many imperfect things teaming together towards perfection. And Shalom is the midah of Aaron HaKohen, right? Hevemi Talmidav Shel Aaron, Ohev Shalom, Verodev Shalom, Ohev Esabrios, Makarvim Latorish, should be from the disciples of Aaron, who loved peace and pursued peace, and loved all creatures, creations, and tried to bring them close to the Torah. That is the midah of Shalom. And Moshe Rabbeinu was the midah of Torah and Netzach, eternity. Whereas Aaron's midah of Shalom is Hod, beauty, glory, whatever. See one second what that means. The Rav Elyameir Bloch, he tells the Rosh Hashiva in his Hesped for his father, the Maril Bloch, Rabbi Yosef Yehuda Leib Bloch, who's the author of the Shirei Das, he said there in his Hesped that what's the difference between Shalom and Emes? Emes is something that can never be changed. It's Emes, it's Emes. Can't change the Emes. Change the Emes, it's Sheker. It's not Emes. And Emes, however, needs to be in this world accommodated to different situations. That's Shalom. Shalom is accommodating the Emes to various different people, different times, in different ways, and that's why Shalom you can change. You can change the Emes for Shalom. Right? You can misrepresent the facts sometimes to make Shalom. And Shalom, and I'm adding this now, Shalom is the name of God. Now, names change according to situations. Names are descriptive. God has many names because each name fits a different situation, a different time, place, or whatever. On the other hand, Chos Moshe LaKodesh Baruch Hu Emes. The seal of God is Emes. There's only one seal. Seal doesn't change. It comes at the end, and that's why Netzach, eternity, is Emes, is Torah, because in the final analysis, the Emes has never changed. But in the short term, the Emes has to sometimes accommodate itself to situations in order for that Emes to be able to be operable. And that's called Shalom. In order to reach Shleimus, you need to be able to accommodate the Emes to different situations. And we explain that in many different ways. One, we explain that it says that when they came to Har Sinai was on the first of the month of Sivan, Rosh Chodesh Sivan. And it refers to it as Bayom Hazeh Bol Midbar Sinai. On this day they came, not on that day. And the rabbis learned from that every day should be new to you like the Torah was given that day. We asked, the Torah wasn't given that day. The Torah wasn't given until the sixth or seventh day of Sivan. And even the process of giving the Torah didn't start on that day. because God let them rest that day. They were tired from traveling. He didn't start the process till the next day, the second of Sivan. So what can you learn from nothing that happened on the first day of Sivan that every day should be new? It's like the Torah was given that day. So once one that explained that the idea is exactly this lesson. God, I'm sure, would have wanted to start the process of giving the Torah as fast as possible. He waited from before the creation of the world for this day, when there'd be enough Jews in the right place at the right time to give the Torah. So let's get started. But he assessed the situation and he saw the Jewish people were tired. And if he would start up with them that day and not let them rest and unpack, it would be counterproductive. So God, according to the situation, waited till the next day to start to give the Torah. That's exactly what everybody has to do. You have to constantly reassess, not the Torah, but your relationship to the Torah, how you relate to the Torah. Some days you have to stay in bed and rest. And some days you have to get up and with a tremendous amount of excitement and effort. Depends on the situation. At some ages, this is the way you have to relate to the Torah. Different age, you have to relate differently, or a different person. In one place, you have to relate to the Torah in one way. In a different place, perhaps in a different way, because the situation is different. In one generation, this is the way that the Torah has to be related to. In a different generation, a different way. And just one quick example is the Michtam Eliyahu. The Michtam Eliyahu says that every generation has its Yetzer Hara, and the way to combat it is to fight fire with fire. You combat it on its own terms, on its own turf. He gives an example. He says, in the time of the Rambam, the Yetzer Hara was Greek philosophy, Aristotle. People were enamored with Aristotle. They thought that whatever he said was the 100% truth. And where Aristotle contradicted the Torah, they opted for Aristotle. So what did the Rambam do? He wrote Mora Nevuchim. He wrote a philosophy book which showed that in most cases Aristotle did not contradict the Torah, and in those areas where he did, the Torah was right and Aristotle was wrong. So he fought Greek philosophy with Greek philosophy. Now if anybody thinks that your relationship to Torah doesn't change, Torah doesn't change, but your relationship to Torah doesn't change, then we are wasting a lot of money on Kiruv organizations that have all different kinds of ways of being Makarav people. Just do what the Rambam did. Right? Go down to Kikar Tzion, or wherever in Rehovot these kids hang out, right? Kids who are at risk, off the derech, whatever. Invite them out, translate the Mora Nevuchim into a language they understand, and read them choice paragraphs on the Mora Nevuchim and tell them, I know why you are estranged from Yiddishkeit, because you think Aristotle is right. So we will read you some choice paragraphs from the Mora Nevuchim, and that will be Makarev them. It worked in the Rambam's time. How many people you Makarev like that? Zero. You know why? Because the Yetzer Hara of this generation is not Greek philosophy, or for that matter, any philosophy. They don't even know who Aristotle is. They think he's a rock star. The deepest philosophical thought, perhaps, of this generation is, should I take ketchup or mustard with my hot dog? And even that's difficult for them to fathom. So, without being too disrespectful to the youth of today, that's not the Yetzer Hara. That's not why people go off the derech, because of deep Greek philosophical problems. Right? It's much different things pulling children off the derech, or for that matter, adults. So the way to reach them has to be different. You have to understand who you're dealing with, and the Torah doesn't change, but the way you package the Torah changes. And that's what it says. It also tells Rosh Yeshiva Lenny Bloch, my Rosh Yeshiva Gift, used to quote him all the time on this. The Navi begs HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Tein li lashon limudim, give me an educated way of speaking. Le'us le'yaef chachma. Le'us, he says, comes from the word ace, to make my words timely, to know how to read the times and say what has to be said for that time and that place and that person, to accommodate what I'm saying to the place, to the person, to the time. Every day the Torah has to be new, as if it was given that day. Assess the time, the place, and know how to relate the Torah to the right time, right place. Tell you a maisa that happened so clearly shows what happens when you don't understand that. When I was a rabbi in Miami, so we saw that, especially amongst the older people of the congregation who didn't know the laws of Shabbos, there were a lot of things that they did on Shabbos that weren't permitted, and they were Shomer Shabbos people. They wouldn't think of driving on Shabbos or turning on the light or answering the phone, but they carried the handkerchiefs in their pocket, and there wasn't an Eruv in the city at the time. And or they carried their medications, and it wasn't pikuach nefesh or whatever. And so we wanted to be mechazik Shabbos in the community. So two or three of the rabbis got together, three of the shuls, and we brought in a very choshev person from out of town, because that's the way, you know, to impress people, bring somebody from out of town, right? Like over here, right? You have very choshev, much more important, bigger Talmidei Chachamim than I am. So what's my mila? I don't come from town. I don't come from Chovet. I come from out of town. So I'm impressive, right? The people in town, you know, they say that when they thought Moshe Rabbeinu was dead by the eagle, and they needed a new leader, so they had some great candidates. They could have asked Aaron HaKohen to be the leader. They could have asked Hur to be the leader. They had some really great people. What did they opt for? A golden calf. Why? Because Aaron and Hur from in town, and the golden calf was from out of town. So the golden calf was more impressive. So we figured we'll do that. We'll bring somebody in who really was a choshev person. We'll bring him in from out of town. He has both milas. He's very choshev, and he's from out of town. He will impress the people, right, much more than the rabbis that they're familiar with will impress them. So we put a lot into this, spent a lot of money, brought this choshev rav down, and he gets up to speak. He has about 45 minutes, an hour to speak. The first 20 minutes of his speech was the following, that he's noticed a terrible affront to covet Shabbos that he thinks has to be addressed. What is it? He's noticed that many people unscrew the light bulbs in their chandeliers before Shabbos and don't give the full light of the chandelier l'kavod Shabbos. And he spoke for 20 minutes about this affront to kavod Shabbos. And let me tell you, in Miami, I don't think anybody had a chandelier, let alone knew what it was. That was not the major burning issue, right, excuse the pun, in Miami about Shmira Shabbos, unscrewing your light bulbs before Shabbos and not giving the full kavod for Shabbos. They were much more serious in Yom. Now, had that Rav asked the Rabbanim in town, what do you think is the major issue here that I should speak about? They surely would have told him not unscrewing light bulbs in chandeliers, right? They would have told him carrying handkerchiefs on Shabbos or whatever, right? But he didn't bother to ask, and he assumed that Baruch Hashem, in his neighborhood, that was the biggest problem on Shabbos. I envied him, right? But it had no shaychus to the people he was speaking to. So I learned from that if I'm ever invited to speak in a place that I don't know, right, the issues, that I always ask the Rabbanim of the place first, what should I speak about? What shouldn't I speak about? Right? What's, you know, an issue that's political or that you don't want me to get, you know, and leave and get you in trouble or whatever? What does the community need? What don't they need? Because I learned from that I don't want to be the guy speaking about the chandelier when nobody has a chandelier. So in any case, so you have to know how to be le'os, le'us, le'yoif chochma, how to make the Torah timely and fit the people you're talking to. And Rabbi Shlomo Kluger says, shalom is not the bracha itself. Right? Why did the Kohanim bless the people with shalom? Because the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, "L'motza Kadosh Baruch Hu kli machzik bracha liYisrael ela shalom." The shalom is the kli. Shalom is the receptacle that makes the bracha possible. So if the Kohanim have to give bracha to the Jewish people, they first have to give them the receptacle in which to put that bracha, that shalom. In our language, it means a bracha has to fit the person. And first you have to give him the shleimus, the shalom, that will be able to accommodate the bracha to his specific time, place, and situation, and nature. And that's why Birchas Kohanim, right, the bracha that the Kohanim give, the bracha of shalom, the Abarbanel says applies to different kinds of people. The first bracha applies to businessmen, people involved in the material world, earning a living and building up the material world. Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmerecha. God should give you wealth, material wealth, and protect you. That applies to that kind of person. The second bracha applies to people sitting and learning Torah. Yoyer Hashem ponav eilecha v'chunecha. That's a bracha for kolol people, for people who are torasim nasim. And the last one, Yisa Hashem ponav eilecha v'yosem lecha shalom, is for soldiers. Those are the three different kinds of vocations in Klal Yisrael. They're the soldiers, the workers, the learners. And each one needs their bracha that fits them. You give the worker the bracha of Yoyer Hashem, it's not his bracha. Right? You give the bracha Yivarechecha to the soldiers, not his bracha. Each one has the kli, the receptacle, which makes the bracha fit that person. That's Birchas Kohanim. And that's what it means. Ohev Shalom, you have to, in theory, love the concept of Shleimus. And Rodev Shalom. Rodev Shalom has two meanings to it. And both of them fit this idea. Rodev Shalom means you have to chase it. All, it's not just one monolithic Shalom that's just always there. You have to chase it in different areas because Shalom changes according to the time, the place, and the situation. So you have to constantly run around and chase it where it is. In addition, the Chasam Sofer says, sometimes you have to be a Rodev Shalom. You have to chase it away. Because for some people, peace and serenity is not good. For a shoyim, it's not good that they should have peace and serenity. It's good that they should chase them away. Because Ein Shalom Omer Hashem L'Rosha. There's no shleimus, there's no perfection when there are a shoyim in the world. So get rid of them. So for them, you have to chase away the shalom. There shouldn't be shalom for them. That's also part of accommodating shalom to the proper place and the proper time. And that's why it says Oei v'sabrios. The Shmuel Razovsky Zatzal said, why is Oei v'sabrios part of shalom? Because if you don't love people, you can't be sensitive to who they are and what they need, and then they can't be shalom. Shalom is always to accommodate it to the person himself. In order to accommodate it to the person, you have to know the person. In order to know the person, you have to love the person. You have to have a keshe. You have to have some kind of connection. That's Ava. So that is a function of Shalom also. And therefore, in Parshas Naso, it starts with everybody having their own specific role amongst the Levim. This one did this, and this one did that, different things. And then the ends with everybody doing the same thing, but with different kavanas. That's Shleimus. Shleimus is accommodating not only the different roles in the world, but even the different approaches, the different attitudes towards the same thing. Two people could be Notal Lulav, and each of them has a completely different mindset in what Lulav does for him. In the end of the Seder of Naso is the 12 Nasiim. Everyone brought the exact same thing. Or as somebody in Miami once told me, they brought a carbon copy of each other. Right? Today that joke is getting to be an anachronism because most young people today don't know what a carbon copy is. What is a... right? Doesn't exist. It's like a dialing a phone, which we still say, but some people say, what does that mean, dialing a phone? Is pushing buttons called dialing? In any case, so there are certain anachronisms that don't apply anymore, and for us old people, it sounds great, but in any case, for those people who laughed at the joke, you showed your age. That's also part of that shalom, okay? And the truth is the Torah was given like that. It was given ki'ish echad b'lev echad, everybody united. And yet, it says it was given according to the power of each and every person individually. There's an idea of the emes of Torah in its long-range totality, which never changes. And then the Torah has to accommodate itself to different situations, different people, different times. You can't put everybody into one mold. Okay. And that's why everybody has a different... even in the Torah itself, how to keep the Torah. For one person, you have to keep the normative halacha. For another person, you have to be machmer. For another person, you have to be nekel. The problem with the generation today is nobody knows what the normative halacha is. So So when they're machmer, they think that's the halacha. So anybody who doesn't do their chumrah, they consider a sinner. And then there are people who are makel, but they don't know that what they're doing is a kula. They think it's halacha. So they think anybody who keeps the halacha is a fanatic. So if people pointing the finger at each other, this one's a fanatic and this one's a sinner, when in fact the people are just keeping what the halacha is, they're not being machmer and not being makel. But every situation needs a different thing. For certain people, the halacha for them is to accept the more lenient opinion when it's proper. But it is proper sometimes. And for some people, what's proper for them is to accept the more strict opinion when that's proper. And for some people, neither the strict or the lenient, they have to keep the normative halacha. But as people keep halacha is different. People come for etzes. Anyone who gives the same advice to everybody, don't go to him for advice. I don't care who he is. Moshe Rabbeinu, don't go to. But somebody who understands that people are different, and the same question from two different people can get two different answers. That's the way it has to be, because the answer has to fit the person. It can't just be a generic answer. And what? Halacha? Yeah, about it. It means to go, but where you're going, right? Sometimes you have to go on a side road, sometimes you have to go on the highway, and sometimes you have to go on another side road to the right or to the left or to the middle, right? If you have a car, you could stay on the highway. If you have a horse, maybe you shouldn't be on the highway, you should be off on a side road, right? If you have a jet, you shouldn't be on the highway either, you should be on a different road. So it depends what you're going in. You're always going. Shaila is how you're going.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Regarding this, whether you're on a kumra or a kula, I complain that the way the Mishnah Rura is written makes it very unclear in many cases exactly what the normative halacha is, because there are so many yeshomrims there.
Okay, I would disagree a little bit. The way the Mishnah Rura is written is not misleading. It's the way some people read it that is misleading. So if you really put your mind into the Mishnah Berurah properly and learn how to learn it properly, you'll find that it's not misleading at all, and you'll be able to figure out clearly what is the normative halacha or whatever. Right? It just takes a lot of effort and a lot of learning constantly, and then it'll be clear to you, even though there's a lot of different yesh omrims, how the Mishnah Berurah brings down the yesh omrim, when he brings down the yesh omrim. And when he says that this is halacha, but bal nefesh yachmer al atzmo, then it becomes more clear. Okay. Second inyan. Okay. And it fits to a certain degree with this, but it's a different topic. And that's from last week's Sedra. At the end of the Sedra, it says the following pasuk: V'ho'ish Moshe onlov mi'ol mikol ha'odam asher pnehu adam. Moshe Rabbeinu was extremely humble, more than any other human being on the face of the earth. You think about that. Moshe Rabbeinu had to write that, first of all, in the Torah. Okay? He had to write, Ish Moshe Onav Ma'od. Okay, God told him to write it. He could say, well, I don't really think that that's true, but, you know, I'll write it. That's ridiculous. He had to believe that every word in the Torah is 100% true, otherwise it's not Pekoros. So when Moshe Rabbeinu wrote, V'ha'ish Moshe Onav Ma'od, he had a mitzvah to believe it. Now, he didn't only write it. He had to teach it to Bnei Israel a few times, the Seder Mishnah. So Moshe Rabbeinu had to take out his notes or whatever, right? The Megillah that the Rabbanu Shem gave him, or Baal Peh, whichever it was. And he had to teach the Jewish people, right? The Ha'ish Moshe, that's me, right? I'm the most humble person on the face of the earth, right? Now, what kind of humility could there be with Moshe Rabbeinu saying that? Same question you can ask on the Gemara. The Mishnah says in Sota that when Rabbi Yehuda Anasi died, humility died with him. He was the last really humble person, perfection of humility. The Gemara says, Omer of Yosef, Al tisnei bat la'anava, don't learn in the Mishnah that when Rabbi Yehuda Anasi died, that humility died with him. Ha'ika no, I'm still around, and I'm very humble. So it's not true. There are humble people after Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, like me. That doesn't sound too humble. So what does it mean? So most people think that humility is thinking you're a nothing. Okay? That's not humility, that's stupidity. unless you are nothing, then it's honesty. But most people are not nothings. Most people have something about them. Right? Now, if Moshe Rabbeinu would have thought he's a nothing, he would have been totally insane. Right? A complete idiot. And the Rabbanu Shlom did not give the Torah to an insane idiot. So Moshe Rabbeinu knew very well who exactly he was and what his potential was, and that he was greater than anybody else, because obviously he was the one chosen to get the Torah, and nobody else in history ever had that schus. So he must be really somebody special. So how could Moshe Rabbeinu be humble? Says the Meshech Chochma, the key is in the last words. The Ha'ish Moshe Onav Miod Mikol Ha'adam Asher Apneihu Adam. Moshe Rabbeinu was more humble because other people were on the face of the earth. Meaning, Moshe said to himself the following. True, God invested in me tremendous potential. I am head and shoulders above everybody in the world. But why? Because God made me like that. And I have the responsibility to take those character traits, those abilities, capabilities and talents that God invested in me and develop them. And maybe I'm not developing them as much as people with less potential and less talents, God-given attributes, are developing their potential. And therefore Moshe Rabbeinu felt lowly. He felt inadequate. Because maybe I'm not developing my potential as much as other people who have less potential are developing their potential. That's the anivus. But it goes even more than that. The Rabbeinu Yonah in Sharei HaAvoda makes the following statement. He says that the foundation of service to God is hakaras malas atzma, that a person should recognize his own self-worth, self-esteem. That is the foundation to Avodas Hashem, for two reasons, he says. We're going to see some other reasons too. But what he says is the following. If you think that you are a worthless good-for-nothing, right, then what would give you the incentive to serve God? Why in the world would God want, with you worthless, good-for-nothing, serving Him? What you do, what is it significant? You're nothing. You're an ant. Is it what an ant does significant? God needs the ant to serve Him. So if you're only a little ant who's insignificant, who's not important, who in what's it called? Totally, your actions are totally irrelevant. Then what gives you the incentive to serve God? But if you consider yourself important, because God made you important, you come from Avraham, Yisrael, and Yaakov, and everything you do is important, right? Then God would want me to serve Him because what I do is significant. Implications, right? There are things that come from what I do. That's why it says in the Medrash in Tanit Ve'Eliyahu, Chayiv kol adam Yisrael lomar bishvili nivra olam. Everybody has to say the world was created for me. Sounds very haughty, but there's an end to the Medrash, even more difficult. The al yomar, you shouldn't say ain olam haba ve'en tchias hameisen. Now, what in the world does olam haba and tchias hameisen have to do with the fact that the world was created for me? And if it wasn't created for me, then there is no olam haba? What's the two things go together? But the answer is, what it means is, a person has to say, God considers me very important. How do I know? Because He created all the worlds. This world, the next world, the spiritual worlds, the physical worlds, all the universes, for one human being. And that first human being was not a male. He was both male and female together. That was the first human being. Vayikare shmam adam, the Gemara says, Ne'erevin, v'yom, hibaram, he called their name. The first human being was either a hermaphrodite, that he was both male and female in the same body, or they were Siamese twins connected at the back, male and female. So it's every man and woman has to say, the world was created for me. The whole world was created for one human being. And therefore, I'm pretty important. Because God created the entire universe, all the universes, for one human being, and I'm one human being. So what I do must be important. And therefore it's not logical to say that God created all of that for 120 years. There must be something eternally important. There must be something universally important about man. And therefore there must be an olam haba and a tchias hameisen. But if I don't consider myself more important than an ant, then the ant wasn't important the first time around. Why do you need an encore? Bring him back for Tchias HaMeisim. But if the whole universe was created for one human being, and I'm one human being, then what I do is so significant, it must be that there's eternal implications. There must be something eternal about this. There must be a Tchias HaMeisim, there must be Olam Haba. That's the idea. And we can see the same importance, a few things. Rosh Hashanah. The fact that God judges us, right, once a year, shows how important we are. Anybody here have a pet, dog, cat, bird, right, hamster, whatever? Would you spend 24 hours a year judging your hamster? Did he keep himself clean? Did he eat properly or whatever? And spend 24 hours scrutinizing your hamster or your dog or your cat? If you would, I'm sure there's somebody here in the community professional could help you. It's ridiculous. Right? Why would you want to do such a thing? It's stupidity. Now, the distance, you'll excuse my insulting you, but the distance between you and a hamster, or for that matter, me and a hamster, is infinitely smaller than the distance between God and us. And yet God spends one day, and with Rabbanan, two full days, scrutinizing us. Hey, what did Lef eat last year? Right? Did he make a bracha? He didn't make a bracha. What did he think? What did he say? Who cares? Why is that more important to God than what my dog did or my cat did? The answer is it is important. A human being, God created everything for him, and everything he does is infinitely, eternally, universally important. And therefore it's worth God's time for a day or two a year, mamish, to just judge every little thing that we did, we said, we thought. More than that, the whole Torah shows the importance. God gave us a Torah that guides every thought, every action, every speech, what we wear, when we work. Who cares? Obviously God cares. So obviously everything that a human being does is pretty important to the Rabbanu Shalom. Important enough to reward us for it or punish for it, because it has universal and eternal implications. So that is the foundation on a positive side of serving God. If you don't think you're significant, if you don't think what you do is significant, why would God want you to serve Him? What would be your incentive to serve God? Why would you think there's anything purpose of serving God? But if you're very, very important, then obviously your service is important too. And it also, on the other side, it prevents a person from doing what's wrong. Because if you think you're a worthless good for nothing, then if you do things that are worthless and good for nothing, that's what you're capable of doing. That's you. So why should you be embarrassed? Why should you be ashamed? What should give you the incentive not to do that? But if you feel that you're an important person, dignified, respectable, and you do things that are undignified and unrespectable and not in befitting you, then you feel embarrassed. Then you feel ashamed. That, I used to say it in my own name, but somebody told me that tells the Rosh Yeshiva of Elimeir Bloch said it, so I said his name. We say after Vidui, Shamnu, Bogadnu, all these terrible things that we did, we end off, Ovarnu amitzvosecho mishpatecho atovin velo shovalon. We transgressed your good laws and lo shovalon. So the simple meaning, I think in the art scroll, it says it was not worth it. We didn't benefit from it. Lo shaveh, lo ayashaveh. Wasn't worth it. We thought we gained from these sins, and in the end it wasn't worth it. But the Tzelzer Shiva says lo shovalon means wasn't befitting me, wasn't equal to me, wasn't befitting. Yeah, I did all these things, but that's not me. Because if I think that's me, then fine. I did what I'm capable of doing. So what should I be embarrassed of? But if I'm capable of a lot better than that, and this is not befitting me, then I can regret what I did and do tshuva. But if I think that's befitting me, that's what I am, then what incentive do I have to do tshuva and not to do those kind of things? And that was the purpose of Maimed Har Sinai. Right? Why did God give the Torah with such a spectacular show? Could have, you know, FedEx us the Torah, you know, with a seal on it or whatever. Why have to give it with Pel, Pen, Kolos, and Brokim, and lightning and thunder, and give it, what's it called, speak to us directly? There are other reasons. But the Torah says the reason. The Torah says clearly the reason. L'man nasos eschem bo Elokim, u'l'man tia yiras Hashem al p'neichem levilti secheto. Nasos means to raise you up, to make you important. God came down special to talk to you face to face. What could be, who could be more important? God considers you important enough to come down and talk to you, literally. And in order that you should have Yiras Hashem, fear of God on your face, Gemara says Zebusha. That is the capability of shame. Because anybody who God spoke to face to face and came down special to give us the Torah has to be somebody special. And if you do things that are inappropriate, you have to be ashamed of it. Because look what I'm capable of. I spoke to God. My ancestors stood on Har Sinai. My neshama was there. And I spoke directly to God. And this is what I'm doing? I shouldn't feel ashamed? Both things. The incentive to do good. L'romei neshem. L'nasos. To pick you up on a banner. And give you busha. And in fact, it says that anybody who doesn't have busha, his ancestors didn't stand on Har Sinai. Now, on the surface, that's very difficult. Because what if you have in one family two brothers, and one is an Azponim and one's a Boshesponim? So did the ancestors be on Har Sinai or not? Right? They both come from the same line. So were the ancestors on Har Sinai? This guy's ancestors were not. This guy's were, but they're the same people. So there are two ways of understanding it, I think. One way is that who your ancestors are is who you relate yourself to. But you can cut yourself away from the hemshech of the doros, from the continuity of the generations. And you can totally alienate yourself from the people who stood at Har Sinai. So his ancestors didn't stand at Har Sinai. The other guys did. His brothers did. But he's separated himself from them. They're not his ancestors anymore. That's one way of looking at it. There's another way of looking at it, which can be explained with something from two parshios ahead. Korach says that when it gives a lineage of Korach, Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kahas ben Levi, but it doesn't trace him back to Yaakov, because Yaakov asked that when Korach will do his sin, I don't want my name mentioned. So on the simple level, like what, we're trying to hide that Yaakov was the great-great-grandfather of Korach? We stop at Levi, and nobody knows who Levi was, right? So we can fool ourselves into thinking, well, this isn't Yaakov. But if you get pretty close to Korach, Ben Yitzhar, Ben Kahas, Ben Levi, you know that the next generation was Yaakov. What did Yaakov Avinu gain? Now, the idea is that just like in physical, genetics, you can have a recessive gene that doesn't show up in the next generation. Three generations later, you have a Gingy from parents and grandparents that were all black hair. Why? Because it was a recessive gene that happened to come out three generations later. Now, it could be that people have also spiritual recessive genes. You could have somebody that is a tzaddik, but he has a weakness within him. That weakness never came out. He guarded it, never let it come from the potential to the actual, but passed on. And three generations, someone came and took that weakness, that weak spiritual gene, and developed it and did a sin because of it. With his own free choice. But he developed a weakness that he inherited from the previous generation that never came out in the generation before. So it's possible that someone stood on Har Sinai, but there were portions of his neshama that weren't standing there, that were weak. He wasn't totality a tzaddik. He was 98%, and 2% was part of him that wasn't standing on Har Sinai. And all the generations after him only related to his strong genes, not to that weak one. And 15 generations later, somebody, that weak gene was developed with his own free choice, and he was an Azponim. So he doesn't come from the one who stood on Har Sinai. He comes from the part of that person who wasn't on Har Sinai. And his brother comes from the part of the person who wasn't on Har Sinai. And that's what Yaakov Avinu said. Yaakov Avinu said, don't put my name by Korach. It could be Levi gave over to Korach certain things that he developed for the bad. And it could be that Kahas did that, and Yitzhar, but not me. Korach got nothing from me that caused him to do what he did or that was developed by him. Nothing from me was in that sin. From Levi, yeah. From Kahash, yeah. From Yitzhar, yes. Not from me. That's what I want clear. Didn't come from me. Okay, hold on. Let me just finish the idea. You can ask questions at the end. In any case, so that's the idea of Maimid Har Sinai. God wanted us to know how important we are. We're important enough to talk to face to face. And we should have and that gives us an incentive to serve God, because we're important. It also gives us the busha not to do things wrong, not to do inappropriate things, because we're people who spoke to God face to face. How could I do things that are inappropriate? Gives you the busha also. So that's one idea of why it's important for a person to recognize his self-esteem and self-worth. Now the second idea. Hold the question, okay? Because I really want to finish this. Second idea is that if you don't recognize your own self-worth and self-esteem, you'll never develop the qualities and potential that you have, because you won't be aware that you have that. It says in Pirkei Avos, Chaviv ha'adam shenivra b'tzelem Elokim. Man is precious, he was created in God's image. Chiba yaseira no daslo shenivra b'tzelem. It's this extra preciousness that God let us know we're created. We could have been created in God's image and been have a tremendous potential. But if we never knew it, we'd have nothing, we wouldn't develop that potential. That was Yaakov Avinu's bracha to his children. He told each one what they can do and what they can't do. You're like this, you have these powers, you have this what's it called, ability, this capability, this talent. Letting them know what their potential was, what their talents, abilities, capabilities, what your self-worth and self-esteem gives you the ability to develop it. Because you don't know what it is, if you ignore it, if you're not aware of it, how could you ever develop it? And not only that, it's also important to let you know what you're not. Reuven, what was Reuven's bracha? Reuven, you could have been the Kohen, the Bechor, and the Melech, and you lost it all. Okay, what kind of bracha is that? I wouldn't come for a bracha like that, but it's a bracha. You know why? It's just like, you see somebody with a voice that's a horrendous singing voice. When he sings, people run in terror. Now, it sounds like dragging your nails on a chalkboard. That's how bad it is. Okay, it has a terrible singing voice. And you see one day the guy going to the library and taking out a stack of books on how to be a chazan. It's not a bracha to go to him and say, look, maybe be an author. Or try to find a home for the deaf and mutes where you could be the chazan. But otherwise, if it's with hearing people, don't waste your time. Because you're going to get up, you're not going to have a minion. Right? As soon as you open your mouth, that's it. You're going to be alone. So it's not worth wasting your time. So it's a bracha to let somebody know what they can't do. So they'll put their energies in those areas where they can do, not what they can't do. Not everybody can do everything. Nobody can do everything. So it's good to guide people into not only what they can do, but what they can't do also. It's important. This is not for you. So, therefore, that's also part of recognizing your own self-worth, recognizing your own strengths and weaknesses, and your capabilities is very important in Avodas Hashem. In addition, there's another idea here. And that is, not only does the Torah give importance to people, but the more important people are, the more important the Torah is. How so? We've explained in the past that one of the ways, one of the perspectives of looking at the Torah is like the owner's manual to a car. You buy a car, you get a book of instructions how to use the car properly. What kind of gas to put in the gas tank, what kind of oil in the crankcase, and so on. And why do you have to listen to that book? I mean, you bought the car, it's your car, you paid for it, right? Why are you bound to listen to some guy who wrote a book and told you how to use your car? Right? Use whatever you want, put water in the gas tank. The answer is, you could, but you didn't design the car. The person or the company that designed the car designed it to run on certain things. And you can do whatever you want with your car, but it's not going to go anywhere because it wasn't designed to run on what you would like to do. You have to follow the design of the designer. So too, God designed this world and He designed us. Only He can tell us what He designed us to eat, to dress, to think, to speak, when to work. That's what the Torah is. It's the owner's manual to the world. If that is one aspect of what the Torah is, then this is also true. When you buy a car, you get a nice thick book of instructions. You buy a computer also. When you buy a stick of gum, it does not come even with one little piece of paper that tells you how to chew the gum properly, or how to, what temperature to put it, you know, what's it called, so it doesn't get ruined or whatever. Why? Because the gum is insignificant. And if you mischew it, abuse it, right, let it get hard on the wrong kind of temperature, buy another one. What's the big deal? It's not worth printing the instructions because it's worth more than the gum is worth. That means that the more important the thing is, the more important the instructions are. The less important the thing is, the less important the instructions. If the Torah is the instruction book for life, if life is important, then the Torah is important. If life is unimportant, then the Torah is unimportant. And that's why right before the Torah was given, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu, Raid Ho'ed Ba'am, go down and warn the people again that if anybody attempts to come up to Har Sinai is going to be liable to a death penalty, and if anybody dies, I'm going to consider it like a multitude of people die. Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Rabban Shalom, Lo Yuchal Ha'am Lalosa. We went through this already. I warned them. We made a boundary around the mountain. Nobody can come up. Why is it necessary to go warn them again? It's not easy running up and down this mountain. Right? Why do I have to go and tell them again? And the Rabban Shalom ignores Moshe Rabbeinu's plea and tells him, go down and go warn them again. So Chazal say very simply, you warn somebody when it's theoretical, you warn them again when it's lemaisa. But let's think of another idea. Why, Taka, it was important to warn them again? God wanted them to know how important they were in his eyes. That even if one sinner, somebody had the chutzpah to come up to Har Sinai, would be killed, in God's eyes it's like a multitude. Because every human being, every Jew, is extremely important in God's eyes. He's important as a multitude. That means that human life is very important. And if the Torah is the guidebook for human life, then the Torah is very important. And right before the Rabban Shem gave the Torah, he wanted the Jews to know how important they were, so when they accept the Torah, they'll know how important it is. That was the purpose. And that, therefore, in order to really appreciate the importance of Torah, it's, you have to appreciate more than the intrinsic value of Torah. How important the Torah is. You have to appreciate how important you are. Because if you're not important, then in that aspect of the Torah being the guidebook for your life, then the Torah can't be that important. And that's why we make two brachas when we learn Torah, or read the Torah at least. The bracha before you really get a handle on what the Torah is, first realize how important you are. Asher bochar bonu mikolo amin, v'nosan lonu es toroso. Right? That's the first bracha. The first bracha before you learn Torah, before you can really appreciate what Torah is, appreciate who you are. Because if the Torah is a guidebook for you, the Torah must be important because you're important. The second bracha is, Asher nosam lanu Torah emes. The chaye olam, not the Torah itself, is very intrinsically important. It's Torah emes, it's chaye olam. But that's only after you read it, after you experience it. Then you can appreciate the intrinsic value of Torah. But before that, before you appreciate the intrinsic value, appreciate your value. Because then the Torah is important because of you. And I think maybe that's what happened by the door of the destruction of the temple. It says the reason that the Eretz Yisrael was destroyed by the first Beis HaMikdash, Shelo Berchu BaTorah Tchila. They didn't make the first bracha. Meaning, they learned Torah. And they kept mitzvahs. And they appreciated the intrinsic value of Torah and mitzvahs or whatever. But you know where their problem was? They didn't make the first bracha. They didn't appreciate how important they were. And therefore the Torah was irrelevant to them. Torah is important, but not to with me. So therefore, Shelo Berchu BaTorah Tchila, they didn't make that first bracha. They didn't make the bracha Asher Bochar Bonu. They made the bracha Asher Nosan Lanu Torah Semes. But they didn't make the bracha Asher Bochar Bonu. They didn't appreciate how important they were. Memela, the Torah was to a certain degree irrelevant to them. Second. And therefore, that is the idea of anivus. Anivus does not mean not to recognize your own self-worth and self-esteem. Anivus is the following. I'm important because God made me important, and that gives me responsibility, and it gives me responsibility. And gaiva is I'm important because I made myself important, and that gives me rights. It's the only difference. A person has to recognize who he is. He has to recognize his own self-esteem, his own self-worth. That's the foundation of Avodas Hashem. It makes the Torah important. It makes you important. It gives you the ability to develop your importance, but it has to be done in a way, asher may call ha'adam asher al pnei adam. God invested me with this potential, and that makes me chayiv, makes me responsible, and maybe I'm not living up to the responsibility that God invested in me. That's the anivos of Moshe Rabbeinu. Not thinking you're nothing. Thinking you're nothing is totally not tolerated. Yes?
You talked about a Rasha coming from Sadi, because somehow from himself the gene came out. It's not all that simple, because the other way around also happens. That sometimes the descendant of that Rasha is a Sadi.
Right. And that because the Rasha also has good portions that maybe he never developed. And some of those good portions went into one of his descendants, and that descendant developed that good portion. And that portion, Taka, comes from the tzaddik part of that Rasha that the Rasha himself never developed. Works both ways, 100%. Okay. In any case, I think both things, if you think about them, have a connection to each other, but those are the two ideas I wanted to bring up.